is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland, online at cottoncloudfutons.com. Coming up in about 2 minutes, Voices from the Edge. Our guest host, Linda Olson Osterlund, talks to Professor Kambiz Ghania-Basiri about the upcoming conference, Islamophobia and White Nationalism in Oregon and the World, at the Oregon Historical Society. That's up next. Then at 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, Heather McCoy talks to Eve Ensler about her new book, The Apology. At 11 on Book Waves, features a 1994 interview with Joseph Heller, author of the classic novel Catch-22, which has just adapted into a miniseries on Hulu. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures, featuring conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. Become a member by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Voices from the Edge with Linda's next.
Spent most of my life in prison.
Criminal records can prevent individuals from moving forward with their lives, particularly with employment and housing. Tune in to Prison Pipeline as we discuss how to get your criminal record expunged.
Join us on Prison Pipeline, May 27th at 6:30 p.m.
Now I'm free. Now I'm free.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Voices from the Edge on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host today, Linda Olson Osterlund. As many of you know, all of a sudden, Joanne Hardesty is the usual host for this show. Since she's become city commissioner, she's realized that she needs to go every other week. So in general, she'll be every other week. Her next time on will be in 2 weeks, however. Look forward to Joanne then. And today, look forward to me. I've got a very interesting topic for us today. The Oregon Historical Society is presenting a panel discussion, and it's called Islamophobia and White Nationalism in Oregon and the World. Obviously a really important topic for us here in Portland as well as around the world right now. I'm really happy to have as my guest one of the two panelists for that discussion. And I will tell you right now, that discussion is going to be coming up at the Oregon Historical Society on the 28th of this month, Tuesday the 28th, from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. And there will be Kambiz Ghania-Basiri, my guest here today, and he will also be on the panel with Steve M. Wasterstrom. They're both professors at Reed University here in Portland, Oregon. Today, I want us to get into a little bit of the history and have a little discussion before we go to callers. This is your call-in show, and it will be absolutely today, so please don't forget to call in if you have a question or an opinion that you want to express about this topic. The number to call is 503-231-8187. So go ahead and write that down if you want, or keep that at hand. I won't open those phone lines for about another 15 minutes. All right, so I want to welcome Kambiz Ghania-Basiri, a professor of religion and humanities at Reed College and the author of A History of Islam in America, From the New World to the New World Order. Thanks for joining me here in the studios, Kambiz.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. And since you are, you're a professor of religion, but you're talking about history here, I want to talk to you about the history of Islam in America. I read an interesting little bit the other day in researching for this, where someone said that it was a historical document that talked about that the very first Muslims who came to America came here before the Puritans.
Yeah, depending on if you think of America as just not the 13 colonies that became the United States, but America more generally, that we know, we don't know exactly who they were, but we know that there were people of Muslim background or Muslims who were on the earliest ships that Europeans used to come to the New World, because, as you know, Columbus was planning to come to Asia, right? And when he went westward,
he brought Muslims. So he had Muslims likely on the ship as well. We're not talking about, this wasn't a slave ship. This was a discovery ship.
Yeah, that there are people who are working on this that believe that he had people who were of Muslim background. We don't know exactly whether there were people who had been Muslims, had converted to Christianity after 1492, when all Muslims were either forced to convert or
in the
Iberian Peninsula after the fall of Granada. So it's very likely that he was expecting to find Muslims when he ended up in the Indian Ocean, and likely wanted people who could speak languages that would be able to speak with them. Mm-hmm. The research on that is not definitive yet. One of the earliest folks that we know that came from Muslim background is recorded in one of the earliest travelogues that we have, written by Spanish. Explorers in the Americas. And his name is Estevanico, who was likely from a region in modern-day Morocco that had been captured for a while by the Portuguese.
Yeah, I think, you know, for many of us, if we do think about Islam historically in Europe, we think, well, where is it in Europe today? And we go to countries that we associate it from then. And we heard about the Ottoman Empire. What does that have to do with it? But more interesting even to me was that I hadn't realized, you know, I'd never thought of it until I'd read some books about this in the past, was that Islam went to all parts of Africa. It wasn't just where it came from in the Middle East. And so, and some of those areas, people had to give up their nativist religions and convert to Islam as part of the rule of the people who came to those parts of Africa. So we also had African slaves who were Muslims. Is that correct?
We also had African slaves who were...
We did not own anybody, but ancestors that came to this country and brought slaves here. Some of those slaves were Muslim.
Yeah, a lot of those slaves were Muslims. Fewer ended up in North America than in South America, but conservative estimates say that there were about 10 to 15% of all the slaves that came to North America were Muslims. We have some of the earliest writings that we have by African slaves in the United States were by Muslims who wrote in this country in Arabic about their lives. But what's interesting about the connection between the history of Islam in America and the white nationalism that is the topic of the panel at the Oregon Historical Society is that it reminds us of how connected Europe was to Asia and Africa. And that connection was created in large part through Muslims. And the fact that we think about European history mainly in terms of the relationship between Europeans and the Ottomans excludes all these other relations that existed with Africa and with other parts of Asia that the Europeans had. And part of that had meant forgetting the history of Islam and how Islam had influenced European history more generally, not just the Ottomans, but Muslims more generally with whom Europeans were trading. And so the history of Islam in America reminds us of that again. And part of the idea of Eurocentrism and white nationalism has been to forget that history of connections, right? To think of Europe as this island that was on its own, that sort of flourished with the discovery of the Americas.
And came to this empty land with just a few natives who welcomed them.
Yeah.
Well, that is very interesting, I think. And so when did we see, you know, when can we look at historically and see examples of the conflict between the between people who wanted to practice their Muslim religion and the Christian religions that were here?
The earliest documented example of this we have goes back to the 1730s, where there's a slave named Ayuba Suleiman Diallo who was a West African Muslim slave who was enslaved in Maryland. And we have reports of him escaping from his plantation to go out and pray. And while he was praying, that people, there were children that would come and taunt him. And he ends up escaping and being captured, and while he was captured, until his owners are found, someone finds that he's able to write Arabic, and refuses to drink wine at it, because back then the slaves, the taverns also held the jail. So
yeah.
Someone had offered them wine, and he refused to drink wine. And there was a British lawyer who recognized him as a Muslim and was very interested in getting him freed, and the governor of Georgia purchased his freedom for him to be able to go back to England. And the idea was that because he came from a more elite Muslim background, that he would help the British expand their trade into Africa. And this is an example of the sort of these connections that we forget.
Yeah, these connections again. And I did read a little bit about that, and I can't remember what I was going to say about him, but he was a pretty interesting person. Oh, I know that they sort of held him up as separate and above the normal slave. So that was one of the ways that they began, once again, this continuous attempt to discern between whites and non-whites, and then make categories within that. So because he was educated and sophisticated and could write, he wasn't considered to, and he perhaps did not himself consider himself to be like the other slaves.
Yeah, because he himself owned slaves, and actually he was captured while trying to trade some cows for slaves. It was a different form
of
slavery.
Some people would have said karma about that. You know?
I mean, the form of slavery was different. It was a chattel slavery that were in existence in the Americas. But yes, exactly, right? So Americans had these assumptions about blacks to justify slavery, and here was a person who was educated, who could read and write, who was civilized, according to their definition, civilized, and so they didn't know exactly what to do with him. So they started redescribing him as someone who's not black, who's not like these other folks. In order to be able to maintain this sort of racializing attitudes towards black Africans that were necessary to maintain the institution of slavery.
Well, as we go forward in this country, and let's leap forward because we want to, we're not going to get to go through the whole history of Islam here, but when did it start becoming a matter of immigration law? And what did the role of immigration law and the government of the United States as it first formed and began to form, when did those kind of conflicts come? And can you give us a little, kind of overview of the main points in history up to now when there's been this attempt on the part of white supremacy in the form of our government or in the form of other organizations trying to, expressing Islamophobia and trying to oust basically Muslims or not allow them to come to this country.
So that also has a long history. So after, the first slaves that come that we definitely know were Muslims and practicing Muslims, some during the slave period of slavery. And then we have another group of people who start coming from modern-day Turkey, the Greater Syria, Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, modern-day Israel, and also Yemen towards the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. And a lot of those folks begin to settle in the United States, and already they start facing forms of discrimination because they were seen as not being either white or black.
So they had to come up with another way of
Figuring out whether or not they could have citizenship. So a lot of these folks end up having their citizenships rescinded because the laws define citizens as say they're being either white or black. So there was a question about where do South Asians, where do we Middle Easterners fit? And a 1915 case decided that the Arab people of Syrian background and the which was a term used back then to talk about Arabs more generally, were considered white. So they were able to maintain their citizenships. But people from Yemen, people from South Asia were not able to gain citizenship.
So dividing the people of the religious persuasion by their racial context and creating it based on I'm assuming it has something to do with darkness of skin, but not entirely.
No, it had exactly to do with the darkness of skin, because South Asians, for example, were arguing that, look, you know, we're Caucasians by race. Yeah. And we have actually a judge explicitly saying, like, well, anyone who would look at you wouldn't think that you're Caucasian.
And I'm assuming that some of the differences in dress, if they persisted here, and in practices within the religion were also things that made Muslims stand out from Christians in a way that could make them be discriminated against as well.
Yeah. At that time, though, in the beginning of the 20th century, there was a lot of fascination with the Middle East, especially as a new crop of rich Americans.
Kind of exotic.
They were seen as exotic, right?
So the Aladdin and his...
Yeah, I mean, the Ottoman that we have, right? That idea came from, like, it was a luxurious piece of furniture that comes to be associated with the Ottoman Empire. And so there were a group of people like Carnegie and so on, who were this new rich class of people that were coming into the American society and becoming influential, who needed to find different ways of expressing their understanding of their wealth in America that was not subject to the church. And this is also why we get Shriners and Freemasons and so on.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. All those organizations started out of Arab background people.
So that they start looking to Islam as a way of, an Islamic mythology and symbolism as a way of expressing this new identity, new American identity that was not directly related to the history of the Christian churches in the United States.
Most Americans are familiar with the conflicts we've had with the Middle East, say post-World War II. You know, the conflicts began, you know, the conflict between Israel and Palestine, and as Israel got formed and Palestinians were driven off. And we think of, you know, I think we think of it contemporarily. So talk a little bit about how this has come to be a point now where we now have a law that's called the Muslim ban. I mean, that's not the actual name of the law. The name of the law is worse, but we have what's known as the Muslim bans under the current administration, where we've actually severely limited the number of people who are Muslim who can come into our country, and specifically listed a bunch of countries that they cannot come from at all.
Yeah. Of course, that's also not, I'll talk about the contemporary period, but it's important to realize that that's also not new, right? So that we have a 1924 Asia Bard ban that restricted immigration from...
Say that again. Say what this one is.
There was a 1924 immigration law that barred people from Asian countries coming into the United States, which was explicitly decided to exclude, before that, we had the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1888. So there were lots of laws that had tried to limit immigration, and at every point, the bringing of new people of new backgrounds, whether racial backgrounds or religious backgrounds, to the United States was seen as posing a threat to American democracy.
Something about America. Let me tell the audience who we are. This is Linda Olson Osterlund, and you're listening to Voices from the Edge on KBOO Community Radio, and I'm speaking with Gambiz Guinea-Bissiri, a professor of religion and humanities at Reed College, and we're talking about an upcoming panel discussion with the Oregon Historical Society. Tuesday, May 28th is when it's coming up, and it's on Islamophobia and white nationalism in Oregon and the world, and Gambiz is going to be one of the panelists there. And so we're trying to bring you up to date a little bit on the history of Islam in America and the history of Islamophobia. The number to call, and I will open those phone lines in just a couple minutes, is 503-231-8187. So feel free to call in, but we're going to go ahead and continue discussing these matters. We're bringing us up to date to, you know, the history of sort of the laws that have tried to exclude people from different parts of the nation, I mean, from different parts of the world coming to the United States up until the current situation. So go ahead and explain a little bit more the different laws that have come up, and then this most recent period. Certainly we know that since 9/11, Muslims have been one of the main focuses of, if you want to say, you know, xenophobia, exclusion. So let's talk a little bit about just before 9/11 and how much 9/11 changed that for people who are Muslim here in the United States.
So in terms of just the history of the laws, then when in 1965 a new Immigration Act was passed to liberalize immigration laws, because after World War II, these sort of race-based ideas of immigration looked pretty horrendous to Americans.
Yeah, we had the examples of the Nazis, and we were trying to make ourselves distinguish from that.
Exactly. And but the idea of the, even the 1965 law that liberalized the immigration, so it didn't restrict it by region or country or nationality, it was mainly intended to allow people from Southern Europe who were also being restricted to by the earlier immigration laws to come to the United States. But the people found out that most people from Southern Europe didn't want to come to the United States after 1965, and the people who did want to come were from Latin America and from Africa and Asia. And that completely changed the landscape of our country. And then to get to the
well, and for many years, I just want to say, for many years, Muslims and became Muslim Americans. And the Pew Research study done after 9/11 shows that Muslims were pretty much the ideal immigrant. You know, they really integrated rapidly. They got educated, built businesses, had their families. They also built places of worship for themselves and carried out their own practices. But they did it in a way that was intended to encourage the average American to see them as normal and like them.
Yeah, and not only for immigrant communities, for African-American Muslim communities, similarly, that was the case. So like groups like the Nation of Islam that people may be familiar with were often known for what they said about the white man being the devil. But if you actually looked at what they tried to promote in America were middle class values, sobriety, hard work, family,
doing for yourself,
yeah. So they were absolutely set up in a way that were ways of using Islam as a way of integrating marginalized communities into American modernity and American wealth in a lot of ways.
And I'm glad you brought up the Nation of Islam in terms of Black Muslim, because that certainly, it both raised fear in white American and was openly talked about that way. Mm-hmm. Muhammad Ali, when he became Muhammad Ali, it was very controversial for Cassius Clay, the boxer, who was pretty audacious and outrageous anyway, to take the stand he made to become a Muslim. And then there was, of course, Malcolm X, that was, probably one of the most famous for having adopted Islam as being more in line with practices that would support Black people, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's had its own backlash and back and forth in the United States, separate from other Muslims coming from outside the country.
Yeah, and some of the early, this was also some of the post 9/11 actions that we see government taking were in the 1960s and 1950s being taken against Black Muslims, right? So it's FBI surveillance
very, very, very significant. COINTELPRO, significant.
Yeah. Definition of Islamic extremism in the 1960s applied to Black Muslims who were coming from them, particularly the Nation of Islam, but also the Moore Science Temple and these other groups that had come into existence.
And for people who had lived in Portland in the 70s, certainly, and the end of the 60s and the 70s, we would see Nation of Islam people selling the Black Muslim newspaper on the streets, as we would see other newspapers sold on the streets, communist newspapers and socialist newspapers. And people would be literally, I can remember Union, which is now Martin Luther King, that street, I can remember, pulling up to certain intersections where you could always buy the current newspaper because people were standing out in the street in a beautiful suit selling the newspaper to express what they believe.
Yeah, and that community still exists. It has converted to Sunni Islam, and it still is a thriving community in Northeast Portland.
But they don't stand out with the newspaper anymore.
No, they don't stand out.
Because I never get to see them, but I do know that they're on cable broadcast.
Yeah. But what's really important also about that is that there were a whole community of Black Americans who were understanding their place in America and their history in America through Islam.
Yes.
Right, through interpretation of that. And they introduced people like Malcolm X introduced another way of understanding being a Black American that did not depend on, the most famous version of this was the TV series Roots, right?
Roots, yes.
That allowed people to be able to define an understanding of Black identity that was not restricted to slavery and Christianity.
And as certain things like Roots was really impactful throughout the whole United States and really changed and informed a lot of white Americans about the history of black Americans in this country. And as those kinds of changes go forward, so do those who are frightened of it and the white supremacy that, you know, we know our history of our Ku Klux Klan and all of that. So let's get to what changed in 9/11. And I do want to let the audience know you can call in. It's 503-231-8187. Do we have a caller on the line? Joe. Hey, Joe, come on to KBOO. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I just want to ask you a question. As a seemingly normal, intelligent, probably above average intelligence for male or female, why on God's green earth would you ever want to support Islam, which treats women, you go to any Islamic country, doesn't matter if Saudi Arabia, UAE, Indonesia, whatever, women are treated as third-class citizens.
I think
you
that,
don't like
Joe.
Wait,
I think
wait. I'm not done.
Joe,
wait, you see the abortion laws that they just
Joe,
tried
I'm
to
gonna
pass?
Let you go. Thank you, Joe. I'm gonna let you go. So that was an example of a caller who has a position that is not going to be probably able us to have a real discussion because he's already said some broad untruths about Islam. We can address those broad untruths briefly, but then other callers, you're welcome to call in, 503-231-8187.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that...
So his what he said represents what a lot of Americans think. Not the majority by any means, I don't believe, but what's out there, that all Islamic women are oppressed.
Yeah.
And
in terms of it being an untruth, what we need to realize is that to say that Muslim women continue to be Muslim while the religion is oppressive to them would mean that Muslim women are incompetent and stupid, and we have all sorts of historical evidence and anthropological and sociological evidence against that, so that's absolutely not true. We have had Muslim prime ministers in Pakistan, in Turkey, in Bangladesh.
That were women,
right? And so none of that is true. But what's really interesting about what he's saying is the way, and what's interesting about understanding how Islamophobia is working today is that this trope of oppressed Muslim woman has been one that has been used to, because of how widely accepted or how widely recognized it is, to promote other ideological agendas, including white nationalism,
yes,
and xenophobia. And because there's this understanding that somehow...
Well, and it was used to promote our ongoing war in Afghanistan. Every
Absolutely.
Time that people talk about pulling out, they say, oh, no, no, think of the women. It's going to destroy the women. But I say, oh, no, 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 think of all the women whose husbands and sons and children are being killed by the bombs that we have going off in that country. No woman is liberated by having her family... you know, destroyed by bombs. And so it always leaves that out, that argument.
And that places Muslim women in such a difficult position because if they are like other women trying to address issues of patriarchy, they always have to worry about, well, can we address patriarchy within our own tradition without villainizing
our
male counterparts, right?
Yes.
Without making our husbands and fathers and brothers and sons into villains, right? So,
and I know that after 9/11 here in this country that some Muslim women who did not wear a hijab or a headscarf before chose to put it on. Brandon Mayfield is an American Muslim who was wrongly accused by the American government of having been involved in a Spanish bombing, a completely incorrect thing. But I met his daughter, and she was a teenager during this time when they had to fight our U.S. government to have him exonerated and freed. And she had never worn her hijab, and her mother had not worn her hijab, but she, just because they hadn't felt it was necessary, but she realized that the depiction of what a Muslim, what it meant to be a Muslim, was being so distorted out there in the world and had nothing to do with or reflect her own reality as a young Muslim woman, that she picked up the hijab and began to wear it at that time. I believe, I don't know if she still wears it or not, but I know she's now an attorney herself.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to recognize that wearing the hijab is a choice for most Muslim women. They make a choice to do it, and it's an expression of their religion, and we certainly need to, if we're real feminists, we want them to be able to make the choice for themselves.
Well, not only is it a choice, it also, in a lot of Muslim majority countries, it became a way of being able, allowing Muslim women to participate in the public, right? So if you were married to someone, or if your father said that, I don't want you to have a particular type of job because it would expose you to unwanted detention
or unwanted detention of
males and so on, that it would run, that because people wore the hijab, they were able to say, well, I have the hijab, so now I could go become a lawyer,
yeah, and I could go and everyone would know, because I'm wearing this, that I'm off grounds for that.
Exactly. So that it became a form of protection that actually allowed Muslim women to go into the public sphere a lot more. If you look at, for example, universities in places like Saudi Arabia now, the majority of students are women. And the donning of the hijab, which started occurring much more in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. and in a lot of Muslim-majority countries, was concomitant with Muslim women becoming much more active in the public sphere.
So it actually was the opposite of what was
Absolutely,
interpreted here.
Yeah.
I do want to let our listeners know what's coming up on KBOO this morning. At 9, it's going to be Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Heather McCoy's show. She talks to Eve Ensler about her new book, The Apology. At 11, it's Book Waves, featuring a 1994 interview with Joseph Heller, author of the classic novel Catch-22, which has just been adapted into a miniseries on Hulu. At 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, featuring conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. All of the KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you haven't become a member for KBOO, or maybe you didn't even realize you could become a member for KBOO, you can do it really easily by going to our webpage and clicking on the button Donate. That's how we're kept on the air. We're a non-commercial station. We're volunteer-driven, and we need your monetary support. I want to encourage you to call in and talk about this important topic, Islamophobia and white nationalism in Oregon and the world. We have a professor from Reed, Professor Kambiz Guinea-Bissari, who's here to talk about this. There's going to be a panel discussion next week at the Oregon Historical Society about this. So please express yourself. Call us 503-231-8187. Lou, I believe we have Lou on the line. Good morning, Lou.
Good morning. Good job with your anti-Muslim phone caller. It may be that some of the right-wingers in Oregon or Portland are kind of targeting Joanne's program. She had a caller, different caller last week, also just trashing Islam as a religion as well.
Yes, I noticed that. Yeah.
So I wanted to say that it's a good topic, good guest. I'm glad to see teachers from Reed helping out with KBOO stuff. I had the forum for the Historical Society on my calendar already, so I'm planning on going. I'm curious about other speakers. For example, if Casey Jama, who's a Somali Muslim who's Unite Oregon, or Randy from Oregon Coalition Against Hate, or Eric Ward from Western States are on that panel for Tuesday night.
No, they're not on the panel, but who is
But the other person who is on the panel is my colleague Steve Wasserstrom at Reed College, who's been doing a lot of work on both anti-Semitism and white nationalism in Oregon locally and internationally since the 1990s.
And are both of you around during the summer? I know as a Reed student in the past, uh-huh. Reed usually is empty during the summer. Are both teachers around during summer?
I am. I'm not sure about Steve, but yes, I'm around during the summer.
Sure. And on local mainstream television this morning, there's news about the Max stabbing, which apparently was related a couple of years ago. I don't know if you were here in Portland then, but to hijab and clothing by Muslim and or black teenage girls.
Yes, one of Reed alumni was involved in that, and who's also a student of mine.
Sure. So in terms of Islamophobia, I'm just curious. I know you're doing retrospective on the history of Islam in the United States and slavery, but in terms of other current white nationalist attacks, there seems like that one in Portland. I noticed that for Charlottesville last year, it seemed to be one of the white nationalist chants was against Jews in particular. Mm-hmm. But are there one or two main things that we should know about of like not just verbal hostility, but actual attacks against Muslim people, say in the last 3 or 4 years? Thanks.
Yeah, there was also the students at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill who were murdered
Tell me about that.
There was a student and his sister who at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill who were murdered about 3 years ago, I believe, because they were Muslims. There are regularly attacks on mosques that the Council of American Islamic Relations reports on and keeps a record of.
In addition, I think it's important to talk about state violence against Muslim people, because certainly from 9/11 on, and in the immediate wake of 9/11, in fact, Muslim men were arrested, I think, over 1,100 in the next day, without any cause other than that they were Muslim men. And so there's been literally violent attacks, and some of them were left in solitary confinement for long periods of time before it was sorted out who they were. Some were, their immigration status was changed and they were thrown out of the country. But I think that those kinds of attacks continue to this day in terms of the way that the mosques in our town are surveilled. Can you talk a little bit about the fear of there's the fear of the Islamophobe who's just a citizen, a white supremacist who might, like there was a couple that was yelled at Max as well, that were really intimidated at Max as well. But there's also the government behind the scenes, the FBI, the Homeland Security, at the very least paying way extra attention to those who are Muslim in our country.
Yeah, I think, in terms of more... broadly thinking about the relationship between Islamophobia and both white nationalism and greater surveillance of U.S. citizens is that Islamophobia has permitted the furthering of, has animated the certain types of both government overreach in large part, right, and white nationalist ideology. Negative attitudes towards Muslims are seen as being so prominent and widely accepted that it's seen as a community that could be targeted without...
They're marginalized. They're certainly marginalized, and people say, well, the FBI probably should be watching that mosque. We do have some more callers. Albert, you're on.
Yes. I would like to ask your guest about Iranian people, specifically women, is about 40 years under brutal regime of Islamic regime, brutal Sharia law, and they're suffering on daily basis. So what do you think about this? I'm from my mother is Muslim, my father was a Christian, and I lived with that society, and I know what the basis of Islam is. Islam is fine if you want to keep it as an individual, but Islam is not fine if you put it as a ruler of a country with the Sharia law.
Albert, so what you're wanting our guest to address is the current situation for women in Iran. I can have him address that just briefly, but really our conversation is Islam in America. But certainly, obviously, right now, Iran is a big topic in the news, and it's part of Islamophobia. And what you're saying is that it's very, very hard for women there and oppressive for women. So I appreciate your comments, and let's have Kambiz talk.
Yeah, the best people who could speak to how Muslim women in Iran are faring are Muslim women in Iran, so I don't want to speak for Muslim women in Iran.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And I would caution you and actually be resentful towards you or other people speaking for them. And your comment in large part poses the sort of challenge that we face, right? How is it that we could think about both the liberation of women more generally or feminism more generally and not vilify an entire community or entire religion along the way? Because Muslim women and Muslims in general are concerned about issues like feminism just like any other religious community or ethnic community or racial community is.
Yes, and in their lives, depending on their personal lives, they have, you know, maybe greater freedom in some ways than women here and less freedom in other ways. So, you know, cultures are different. But, you know, people like to bring up Sharia law when we're talking about Islamophobia here in the United States. But, you know, there's no Sharia law in the United States. So I think that's just a distraction, frankly. It's not a valid thing. We're not, there's no county in America that is run by, you know, Sharia law. So I just want to get that out there. I do believe we have,
Can I say something about that? Because I think that's actually another important point here. So there is Sharia law in the sense that every time a Muslim prays or a fast,
that's an expression.
This is the month of Ramadan, right? They're following Sharia law, right? So Sharia is what it means is divine law, according to the Islamic tradition.
So is there religious law?
Yeah, so it's a religious law that Muslims follow. So the ways in which they pray is following those laws. The way they fast is following those laws. So the people are following those laws.
So and I see what you mean, yeah. When I say there's nobody under it,
And what's really important and speaks to how what I was saying earlier about how Islamophobia is propagating particular types of ideology, the whole sort of fear of Sharia or anti-Sharia legislation that has been proposed in a number of states, including our own, in Oregon hasn't gone very far, makes no sense whatsoever. And any expert in law has said that it makes no sense whatsoever, because if it's a matter of praying, that's protected by the Constitution, and if it's a matter of actually imposing a certain type of religious law on Americans, that's illegal. Like, that cannot be done because the law of the state or the law of the federal government overrides all of that.
Constitution says overrides they may not.
So what's the point of these legislation? To me, the only point of it is to undermine the legal system, so that now once you have in the public discourse this anti-Sharia legislation discourse around, and any time Muslims go to the courts to assert their rights, any judge that agrees with them, allows them to assert their rights, comes to be tainted as, you know, pro-Sharia or pro, right? It creates a public discourse that prevents Muslims from being able to actually assert their constitutional rights. And the reason why groups, anti-Muslim activists, have done this is precisely because the courts have been one of the refuges for Muslims, where they have been able
because
to assert their rights.
Because we have a constitution that does protect their religious
exactly.
rights.
Exactly. So what they're doing is attacking those places in our legal system, in our system of government, where Muslims could actually assert their rights, right?
Yes. And we know that the Trump administration is busily trying to put people in positions of judgeships who have biases, who are white supremacists and have biases against women as well.
And what it does is undermines the trust in the legal system, right? And that's what it seems to be intended to do. So
yes.
That any legal system that actually allows the Constitution to be upheld for marginalized communities comes to be seen as not trustworthy, un-American, or so on.
I see what you're saying. I believe we have another caller on the line. Mitch.
Yes.
Good morning.
Thank you for having this discussion, and I hope that we can fill in some missing elements of the discussion of how Islamophobia rose in the West. When what's the element that seems to be missing from our discussion is the role of business competition in history, and that the conflict between the rise of the Ottoman Empire, which was not a doctrinaire Islamic halal-based empire. It was a militaristic and business-based empire that competed for North African hearts and minds with the rising Western Christian empire. And that before the Ottomans rose, there was the Eastern Byzantine presence all across North Africa, which was traditionally the borderlands between the Islamic world and the Christian world, as the Islamic world rose, because the Christian world was there earlier, and the battle for hearts and minds over North Africa and the native Berber or Amazigh population had to do with the competition over pagans and resources on the southern Mediterranean coast.
So the
absence of you discussing, for instance, what an admittedly former right-wing ideologue in America tried to exploit. His name is Max Boot. I went to UC Berkeley at the time when he was organizing there, and his first book was about the first foreign war that Jefferson got the United States involved in. It was over the seafaring in North Africa because the Barbary Coast was totally controlled by Islamic business interests, and America wanted in, and America also wanted, and Europe wanted to defend itself from being enslaved by the Barbary seafaring
masters.
Well,
I hear what you're saying, and I think you're bringing up a really good point. Let's let Cambyse speak to the point of what the role of economic competition, basically, between different peoples and nations played in the development of Islamophobia.
So I'm not sure with the extent to which the economic competition in the period you're talking about related to Islamophobia. I'd be interested in hearing how you see the connection more. But what happens in the region that you're talking about with the Europeans coming into the Americas, they sort of give the Mediterranean region to the Ottoman Empire, right? So when you look at when the Ottomans come to occupy and most of North Africa is right after Europeans begin to turn their attention to the Americas. And of course, that becomes a problem for the Ottomans. And the Ottomans try to protect their control over the Indian Ocean, but they decide that they're not going to go into the Americas, and that ends up being a hugely important role in the way in which the world gets reconfigured, because there was a lot of gold and silver found in the Americas
and definitely the role of oil and European countries in the United States trying to control Muslim countries in the Middle East, or what are called Muslim countries, trying to control the oil trade. Certainly that's a big motivator in
the 20th century. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in the 20th century, countries like Saudi Arabia began to flex their muscles a bit through the oil we saw in the 1970s. A lot of these anti-Muslim, anti-Arab attitudes emerge in the public.
I keep getting amazed at how much I forget. Yeah, it was such a big deal. You know, it was considered just, horrible that the nations of the Middle East were joining together to set prices for oil. And that was a big, big part of conflict with the Middle East from the United States. And it was in the public eyes, they were seen as greedy sheiks, I think, mainly, you know, like these greedy oil men with their kafitas on, their kafitas, Arab dress, and that they're just trying to keep all of the oil for themselves, forgetting that oil is in their lands geographically, that oil that they were trying to determine. But yes,
but
it was.
But oil is a factor very late in the game.
Well, it is late in the game, but it's the one that's the most, it's one that's still there playing such a big role today.
But here's the thing, Linda, you know, I think what you're trying to do is impose this right-wing, left-wing grid over what drove the world, and Max Weber saw this in his writings about Mediterranean capitalism and his even pre-Marxist critique of it, but he was a champion generally of the interpenetration of cultures in the Mediterranean and how vibrant that trade was in the Mediterranean, capitalistic trade. So if we try to impose, and I tend to lean left too, if we try to impose a right-wing, left-wing grid on it, we lose historically the fact that there was a presence, a seafaring presence, by Muslims. They weren't all doctrinaire. You look at the novels
of
Melville.
But you know what? I don't think
Wait a minute.
Let me address one of the points you made, which was that I'm characterizing it as a left-wing, right-wing. I wasn't, actually. I don't consider that these issues are necessarily, that it's necessarily a right-wing, left-wing to say that the nations that came out on top on World War II attempted to take control of oil wherever they could, and they are still attempting to do that to this day, and that's a major motivator economically in the in imperialism. So I don't think that's left-wing, right-wing.
Yeah.
Just a description of what's happening.
Where it becomes left-wing, right-wing is in the left being baited into these identity politics and starting to equate the Nation of Islam, which was largely an adaptation of blacks being rejected by Christian mainstream society. You'll notice that Farrakhan
has
little theologically to do with the Islamic world, and that's in fact what caused the rift with Malcolm X.
I'm gonna let you go because we can't just have a monologue right now. We need to be able to discuss discrete points. So thank you anyway for your call. And I'm going to let you go at this point. Is there another caller on the line?
Yes, Carl.
Carl, thanks for calling in.
Yes. Oh, and I was just going to say I liked that last caller you had on there. Very interesting. But I was going to say is this is nothing new. Read history. You remember the Crusades?
Well, yes. I have heard of the Crusades and the Inquisition as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's been going on for a long time. It's sad, but that's how it is.
Where do you fall today in the question of Islamophobia? Do you feel that we should treat... How do you feel like about the Muslim ban?
I think it's crazy myself. But I'm just saying I know Muslims. I've never been to the Middle East or anything, but I know Muslims. They're people just like anybody else. And I sit, I'm in a retirement place, but I sit with a man who's just, well, I guess he's far to the right, or I don't know what, but we have arguments all the time about this, and he just says they're no good and all this stuff, and it really irritates me. But there's one book that came out about 40 years ago. It's called Warriors of God, and it covers all the Crusades. There are no good people.
Well, I hear you about that. Would you like to ask a question of Combees or have him comment on your comment?
Well, yeah, he can comment on what I said.
Okay, thank you.
So, I mean, we're all flawed.
So, I mean, if I, one of the reasons why I'm interested in the study of history is that we don't have to think about the present moment through the Crusades, right? That there's a long history of actually interaction and cooperation that has also existed. If you look at any of the major cities today, whether it's New York, any major cities in what we call the quote-unquote the West, right? Barcelona, Madrid, Paris, London, Los Angeles, New York. Look at any of how multicultural there are. Right, the Crusades doesn't help us explain the world in which we actually live today. There's actually been a lot of interaction among people of different backgrounds, religious background, Muslims and Christians. So just as we have had the Crusades, we've also had Muslim Christians making distinctions, Christian empires making distinctions between different communities of Muslims, allying themselves with one group against the other, Muslims allying themselves with certain Christian groups against other Muslims. So these relationships, and down to today, right? When we invaded Iraq in 1990-91, there were a lot of Muslims who invaded Iraq along us, right? To kick
and
Kuwait
books
out.
Were written called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, and there's many people who still hold that dichotomy as if there is a good Muslim and a bad Muslim somehow based on what their beliefs are.
Rather than the ways in which we have together participated in addressing the challenges that the world has tossed our way. Mm-hmm. And I think so one of the ways in which, one of the reasons why I'm interested in this study of history and drawing attention to sort of the history of Islamophobia is to see that there are other possibilities out there too, right? That there are things that Islamophobia is doing that is Islamophobic attitudes, government policies are doing that have nothing to do with actually Muslims, but actually
with
the way
reality
in which,
of life in America with Muslims.
Yeah,
and
with
if
the
you
ways in which we try to deal with governance of our country, right?
Yes.
So that we have, you know, like... Again, with the Muslim ban, so that's one way of thinking about American national identity today, but it was also similarly thought about in the 1920s. It was thought about in the late 19th century.
Well, and as had been said, is that every time we come into any kind of, you know, crisis in the United States, we tend to, you know, especially if we're talking about war, and we have a president right now who has admitted that his top advisor would have him in four wars if he would allow him to. That's John Bolton.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's so much more about the interactions between Muslims and Americans and Muslim Americans that it gets all wiped over, and we want to throw people out of this country whenever there's a crisis. It was Japanese. We wanted to put in internment camps, and which was interesting was that we didn't crack down on Germans near as much. And so there's, once again, that racial entity that plays in that. I want to see if we have any more callers on the line.
I mean, to be a...
John, do we have any more callers on the line? I'm asking our... Okay, so that was it. I wanted to go back to, I know we've got so much more to discuss, but I want to go back to talking about the panel. And so for the audience that may have just tuned in, this is Linda Olson Osterlund on Voices from the Edge. And I have with me Kabiz Ganea Bissari. I never say his name completely right. He's a That's professor fair. From Reed of Religion, and he's the author of the book, A History of Islam in America, a really thorough and dense book, but a really interesting book because there's so much more about Islam in America than I ever knew. We're talking about it because there is going to be a panel discussion coming up next week, Tuesday, at the Oregon Historical Society here in Portland. And the title of that is, I want to give it right, so I'm pulling my page up, is Islamophobia and White Nationalism in Oregon and the World. That's going to be at the Oregon Historical Society this coming Tuesday, May 28th, at 6:30 p.m. And it's free and open to the public. And the Oregon Historical Society's address, for those of you who don't know where it is, which includes me, I mean, I know where it is. It's on the park blocks, but I don't have the address right here in front of me. I'll look up the, here's the address. It's 1200 Southwest Park Avenue. So it's the Oregon Historical Society next Tuesday at 6:30. Kumbis, is there anything you would like to say about the panel discussion? You're going to be on that discussion, and you're going to also be on it with Stephen Wasterstrom, mm-hmm. who is also a Reed College Humanities professor, and he's going to be talking about Islamophobia here in Oregon. He's been doing more research on that in specific, right?
More specifically on white nationalism in Oregon.
Oregon. Yeah, so it's an important conversation, and I find it really gratifying that the Oregon Historical Society, sometimes we think of historical societies as being really staid, but this one certainly is not.
Yeah, I think people are beginning to realize that our world is much more complicated than the narratives that we've been handed, and that entities like the Oregon Historical Society need to go beyond their usual historical narratives that they have offered to recognize this complexity of the world in which we live today. So I'm really glad that they're...
When I grew up, the history was all about, the wagon trains that came to, that was pretty much, and it took a long time for even the history, and the Oregon Historical Society has played a very good role about this, talking about the true history of race in Portland and in Oregon, and our history of, with the Ku Klux Klan and of exclusion laws and sunset laws and redlining and and the targeting by the police up to this day. And so it's very important that we have something like the Oregon Historical Society is going to say this is part of our real history. We're not going to take it out of history.
And it's important to think about this, and maybe not so much an example, like a quick example I could give that's not Oregon specific necessarily, but when we think of like what happened in Katrina, right, how devastating that that was. And part of the reason why we responded to Katrina the way we did was because after 9/11, we ended up putting FEMA under Homeland Security. Right, so how natural disasters, response to natural disasters, what does that have to do with Homeland Security? But because of this sense of threat of Muslims and Islamic terrorism that people had, we ended up making these decisions that then allowed this government bureaucracy not to be able to respond adequately or respond to natural disasters by securitizing them rather than thinking about the citizens and the people that they're supposed to help.
Yes.
And we see this all over the place, right? So we see our police departments changing to see themselves as not serving citizens but actually being protectors of, rule of law. Of the homeland. And so so all of these things are connected. And unless we begin to think about the complexity of the worlds in which we're living and the way in which our country is also involved in shaping this history, we won't have the tools to be able to address them.
Well, and I really appreciate the conversation this morning in bringing up things that I had not thought of in a long time. And when you talk about the complexity of history, it's so easy for us to go for the most current big headline that's in our mind. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The thing that's most currently going on. And we forget about that it's not as simple as that. And when we make up simple decisions, that they don't help us. For example, I'll just say it once again, the Muslim ban makes no sense. It does nothing to make us more secure. All of the acts of almost the overwhelming majority of acts of violence domestically here have come from the right wing, have come from white supremacists, have not come from, if we look out in the world, we would see we don't have to fear from the Muslims who come here who want to be part of America.
Yeah. And the people of Muslim background who were involved in attacks like 9/11, none of them came from the countries that we are banning people from coming
to. No, they didn't come from those countries, and they weren't people who lived here already. They weren't secret moles or any of the types of things they raised to be afraid. So once again, I've been speaking with Professor Kambiz Ghania Basiri. He's a professor of Reed, and he is going to be on the panel discussion this coming Tuesday night, May 28th, at 6:30 at the Oregon Historical Society. It's free and open to everybody. It's 1200 North Park in the North Park blocks. I want to thank the audience, and I want to thank those who called in, and I want to thank you, Kambiz, for being here with us today. And next, we will be going to Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell.
Thank you so much.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light, hey. Stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9:01. Coming up next is Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's the Heather McCoy Show. Heather talks to Eve Ensler about her new book, The Apology. Then at 11, it's Bookwaves, featuring a 1994 interview with Joseph Heller, author of the classic novel Catch-22, which has just been adapted into a miniseries on Hulu. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures,